We shall turn now for a little to the consideration of the Word of God in the Psalm 24. We come to the Psalm 24, which according to the title is another one of David's Psalms, one that he was inspired to write for the good and benefit of Christ Church. And this, I believe, we can identify among the Psalms as another one of the royal Psalms. It's very obvious that this is the case when there is so much emphasis upon the King of Glory stressed in the Psalm. But it is also, I believe, a messianic Psalm because it directs our minds beyond the time in which David penned these words to someone greater and beyond himself. And then also, I believe we can consider it as a prophetic psalm because it is speaking of things that were to be filled in a glorious way in the future. And with this in mind, we shall give consideration to the psalm as a whole. It is good to note what is stated in verse 6. This is the generation of them that seek him, that seek thy face, O Jacob. And very often it is translated, O God of Jacob, because it can mean either Jacob, the people of God, or the God of Jacob. This is the generation of them that seek him. And therefore, this psalm in reality is not just praise, but it is the language of those who are seeking after God, seeking him and seeking his blessing, because when you look back to verse 5, we're told of him who shall receive the blessing from the Lord. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. And those who are seeking the Lord, surely that's what they're seeking him for. Why would they seek God for any other reason than they would desire his blessing? Now, sometimes people are confused as to whether God intends to give them a particular blessing. They may question whether they've even the right to seek such a blessing, and they may be in a quandary sometimes. Have I received anything from the Lord at all? Have I received his blessing? These words are words of instruction, and they are words of edification, because we're told of someone who definitely does receive. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord. And surely that's what we've come here this evening for. What's the point of a prayer meeting if we're just gathering as a social gathering? We're not really seeking God. And even if we are, we have to inquire, well, what are we actually seeking him for? What do we really want from God? Are we really desiring? That's why we're seeking him, because we desire his blessing. And one thing we know is this, that the blessing of the Lord, it enriches. It maketh rich. And if God is blessing us, we will know, because we will feel in our souls we are to some degree enriched. We have improved. We've received something that enriches us spiritually, something that enriches us as far as our knowledge and our understanding of the things of God is concerned. Now, right away, it is important then, if we are seeking God, to know something about him. And this is what the psalmist refers to at the beginning of the psalm. He says, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." This is the God that is being sought. This is the God from whom a blessing is being sought. The earth, the psalmist says, is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof. There isn't anything in it that doesn't belong to him. Absolutely everything belongs to him. Every blade of grass, every bird that sings, every creature that walks on the face of the earth, and all that dwell therein, every beast and every man, belongs entirely to God. Now, of course, we know perfectly well that not all are pleased to serve God. There are those who rebel against God. There are those who disobey God. But that doesn't alter the fact of which the psalmist speaks. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. They belong to God. And we were singing from the psalm that the nations are under his control. You and I sometimes, when we look around and we see the chaos and we see the wars and we see the fragmentation among nations and societies, we might think, well, everything's going out of control. And when we look at what's happening in our modern present generation, we might have reason to think, well, everything is spiraling out of control. But the psalmist says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We cannot turn to any point in it. We cannot look in any direction. We cannot observe any activity, anything, and not believe it all belongs to God. He's overruling it all, and the world and they, every man, woman, boy and girl, they all belong to him. You and I do not belong to ourselves, we belong to him. And of course, the children of God who are born again of the Spirit of God, they are not only God's by creation, but they are God's by new creation. But whether they are in a state of grace or in a state of nature, this is what we have to recognize. We're seeking a sovereign God. We are seeking a blessing from God who owns and rules over absolutely everything, the very fullness of it. Now you try to think, what's involved in the fullness? You think of this world of ours just at this very moment. What's going on all over the world, in every society, in every country, in every community? Think of everything going on. And if we were able to look down upon it all and see it all at any one moment, this is what we know from what the psalmist tells us. God owns it all, and he's controlling it all. He hasn't lost control of this world of ours. However much men may think they're in control, the child of God knows God's in control. And the psalmist goes on to say, "For he hath founded it upon the seas and established it upon the floods." God founded it. He brought it into existence. And he hasn't given it away. Yes, when he created man, when he created Adam, he told him that he was to have dominion over the creatures. He made him the ruler, as it were, to rule over the created world. He put him into a garden to dress it and keep it, to protect it, to watch over it. Now Adam failed, but it is just like a servant serving his master. He does his master's will, and it is his master who owns and controls. And so if the servant disobeys or the servant rebels, it doesn't mean that the master has lost control. He still owns everything. He still is in control. And when man is rebellious against God, it does not diminish God's sovereignty over all his creation. And what a comfort that is to God's people. It amazes me sometimes at how anxious and how even distraught some of the Lord's people become when things seem to be going in the direction they think they shouldn't be going. And even when it comes to politics, Christians can get alarmed. What's this government going to do? What are these godless politicians going to do? God is in control, and he punishes and he judges and he afflicts. And when we look at our society, we marvel that God is actually so long-suffering. We wonder that we aren't consumed like Sodom and Gomorrah. When we look around us, God is truly long-suffering. He is the owner of it all, the governor of it all, and he has been provoked constantly, day after day. He is long-suffering. And when we read these words of one, he shall receive the blessing from the Lord, we must marvel that there is any blessing. We must truly wonder that God, who is so provoked, has any blessing for any. And yet this is what we read in this psalm. Now then, because of who God is, the psalmist asks these questions. Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Who shall make an approach? Who shall come into the presence of this great and glorious God? If he is ruling over it all, who does he permit into his divine presence? If this God is so great, then surely we must know that to come into his presence is a great privilege. To come before him is truly a very favored privilege. And the psalmist says, who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? And the psalmist goes on then to describe who it is who may stand in the presence of God. Now let us look and see what is required. He that hath clean hands and a pure heart. Now we might well then stop. And we might well, considering these words, think to ourselves, well, that means I'm barred from his presence. Because I cannot claim that my hands are clean. And I cannot claim that my heart is pure. We heard in the prayer, reminded of what Jeremiah said, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And when we read these words, we might then come to the conclusion, well, whoever can stand in the presence of God, it isn't me. I will have to be like the publican standing afar off. I can't come in, I cannot ascend into the hill of the Lord or stand in his holy place. Now you have to understand that when David is writing this psalm, he's writing it at a very different time in history to what you and I are living in. And he is living in a very different society. And therefore we have to cast our minds back. What would be in the mind of David? What was he talking about when he talks about ascending into the hill of the Lord or standing in his holy place? Now we know that at the time when David was writing the psalm, there was no temple. It was built in Solomon's time. So David has to think of the tabernacle, the holy place where God made his presence known among his people. And very probably what's in the mind of David here is the bringing of the ark that had been carried away by the Philistines when David was bringing it back to its rightful place. There was great joy, there was great singing. And you can imagine the procession coming with the ark, the priest bearing it to bring it back to where it belongs. And they're singing as they come to the place where God's honor dwelt. Who shall ascend? They are singing, into the hill of the Lord. Who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. Now, immediately you read these words, you have to conclude they're just a summary of an upright, honest life of integrity. A life that is conformed to the teaching of God's law. That's what the psalmist has in mind. Because none dare come before God who were deliberately defiant of God, deliberately breaking his law, deliberately living in rebellion to him. And yet even those who would know, well, I've got to live according to God's law, they would know perfectly well that they would break it continually. The fact they had to bring sacrifices reminded them they were sinners. They were guilty. They couldn't approach God without a sacrifice, without an atonement to cover their sin before God. But here is what we're told in verse 5. It's this person with these credentials, with this righteousness, with this godliness, this justification before the law, because that's what it amounts to. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord. Now it doesn't say he shall receive a blessing. He shall receive the blessing. It's as though there's one particular blessing that God bestows on them who appear in his presence justified before God's law. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. What does it mean? He shall receive righteousness. He shall be declared righteous. God will justify him. He's righteous. He shall receive the great blessing of righteousness. but he has to appear in the presence of God to receive that blessing of righteousness. And you might be thinking, well, that immediately rules me out. I can't have this blessing because I can't approach to God, because I can't claim that my hands are clean, and I can't claim that I'm pure in my heart. If God knows me as I know myself, he knows perfectly well that I can't be justified by my righteousnesses. So where does this psalm point us? As we said, it's a royal psalm, but it's a messianic psalm. And here is the psalmist speaking of one who is qualified to ascend into the hill of the Lord and to stand in his holy place. Not to kneel, not to prostrate himself, but to stand in his holy place. Now it is interesting to understand how those in David's day, and indeed even to this day, those who appear in the presence, or imagine they're appearing in the presence of God. If you were to go, I've never been there, but I've seen lots of photographs of it and films about it. When men go to Jerusalem to what's known as the Wailing Wall, indeed, when the young Jewish boys are going to the Jewish schools to learn the law, you observe, it's very interesting. The human heart is just so given over. The human mind is so given over to the preservation of external customs and traditions. And it's as though just so long as we perform certain acts, God will accept us. Here we're told that the one who ascends into the hill of the Lord shall stand in his holy place. He has to be peculiar. Have you ever seen, and indeed in the Islamic schools, when the boys are there learning the Quran, they act in the same way. Did you ever see them standing at the Wailing Wall, and they're standing with the Tanakh and the Torah, and they are reading it out loud? Of course, you'll see them with their shawl out over their heads, and the reason is that because they're all reading differently, and they're supposed to not hear what their fellow is reading or praying. And they put it out over their head. But you will see them bowing and raising and bowing and raising as they read or as they pray. And that's how it appears, because it's going at such a speed. And yet, in slow motion, what they do is they bow in the presence of God, Jehovah. They bow, and then they bend over. Now, when you see it happening, it's just so fast. It's as though we get through this exercise as quickly as we can, and then when it's over, we're happy because God's happy. And you see, so many imagine that as long as we go through the outward externals, God's happy. But that is not the case. When here we read these words of who shall stand in his holy place, you're not talking about some hasty appearance in God's presence, some momentarily appearance, just get through the motions, appear before God, satisfy Him, be pleased with Him, and He'll be pleased with us, and the business is over. Here we have someone who comes into the presence of God and stands in His holy place, stands before God. Doesn't have to bow, doesn't have to prostrate himself, but stands. And there's only one that we know that can in reality stand in the presence of God, and that is the one whom God has exalted to His own right hand. But He ascends into the hill of the Lord. He stands in His holy place because He has clean hands. He is perfectly innocent. He has kept the law perfectly and His heart is pure. There's only one that fits this description. There's only one that in the universe to whom these words can truly apply. And because He is lifted up, He has not lifted up His soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully. Here we have one who is not only clean and pure, but He hath not lifted up His soul unto vanity. He's honest. He is true. He is genuine. There is no pride, there is no arrogance, there is no haughtiness in him. He hath not lifted up his soul or his mind unto vanity. There's no vain thoughts going through his pure heart and pure mind, nor has he sworn deceitfully. But he has sworn. He has sworn in eternity. He has sworn to redeem his people. He has sworn to bring a people nigh unto God. He has sworn to atone for their sin, to do all that is required on their behalf. And when he comes and appears before God, he is received. And he can stand. Now the high priest in the Old Testament, he stood. That was required in his work. He stood at the altar. He stood at the altar of burnt offering and sin offering. He stood at the altar of incense when he went into the Day of Atonement into the Holy of Holies. He stood to sprinkle the blood and so on. He stood. That's the posture of a priest standing accepted before God. And this is our great high priest who is after the order of Melchizedek. And he stands. He stands in the presence of God to receive the blessing. He shall receive the blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Now then the question arises, how does he receive the blessing? The word blessing sometimes is translated benediction. He shall receive the benediction from the Lord. And who has received the benediction or the blessing from the Lord? The one who at his baptism, you remember the voice when he came before John the Baptist and fulfilled all righteousness and required that John would baptize him. Then John witnessed the Spirit descending upon him in the form of a dove. And a voice from heaven gave the benediction, gave the blessing "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. I am well pleased because his hands are clean. I am well pleased because his heart is pure. I am well pleased because he hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity. I am well pleased because he has not sworn deceitfully." And there is only one of whom that can be said. That blessing, that benediction is reserved for one and one only, the Son of God in our nature. The blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of our salvation. Why did God say, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased"? Because he could say to his Father that he delighted to do his Father's will. "Yea, thy law is written in my heart." Thy very law is written in my heart. And so when God says, "This is my beloved Son," and gives that benediction and that blessing, what does it mean? He's accepted as righteous before God. And because he has that righteousness, he is able then to impute that righteousness to those who are united to him, who are joined by faith to him. Their righteousness is not their own. Their righteousness is his righteousness. And therefore this psalm is pointing us to the glorious Redeemer himself. We get a picture of one who stands out from all others. One who is able to stand where no one else can stand. He can stand in God's holy place. There is no way that he can be dismissed or driven out of God's presence. There he stands. This is the generation then that seek him, that seek thy face, O God of Jacob, the God of the covenant. Now then, when the psalmist speaks of this one, and he's asking the question previously, who is it that shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? It is so that our minds might be focused on the one and discover the one who's able to do this. And when we discover him, then verse 6 at the end of it, we have that Selah. Let us pause, as it were. Let us think of the one who's received the blessing. Who is he? What blessing is it? On whose behalf has he received this blessing? We're supposed to meditate, supposed to reflect upon that before he moves on. And then we see that this psalm isn't just a royal psalm, a messianic psalm. It is a prophetic psalm, because we hear this voice, verse 7, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." And then the question is, well, who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Some imagine that there's really two psalms here instead of one, but I believe that it is a continuation, Selah. Let's stop, let's think, let's reflect upon the one who has ascended into the hill of the Lord. He is unique. He is qualified then as the one with the blessing. For whom has he received this blessing? Lift up your heads, O ye gates. The scene here that is depicted is of a mighty conquering warrior monarch. And he approaches the city. If you were in Scotland or parts of Europe, you would understand exactly what the psalmist is speaking about, because there in castles and old, where there are still remains of old city walls, you would see some places are still preserved, the portcullis, where you have a great iron gritted structure that can be lowered, and if the enemy is approaching the city, they can't enter. They're barred. The doors behind it are closed, and even if they're not, the enemy cannot get in. And they are lowered down and they are raised up. And this is what's depicted here. The King of Glory has arrived at this city. He's the mighty King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he seeks admission. And here the command is, lift up your heads, O ye gates, open up, for there is a special personage here to come in. He cannot be barred out, he cannot be kept out. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be lift up to permit his admission into the city as the great conquering king he is. Who is this king? That's the natural question. The guards on the city walls, or the keepers of the gates, when admission is required, they want to know who it is. Who seeks admission? Who wants into this castle? Who wants admission into this city? Who is it? What authority does he have? On whose commission does he come? And the answer comes back. He is the Lord strong and mighty. He is the Lord mighty in battle. He has the right, because of who he is, to come in. Now, you remember, and this takes us back to the experience, no doubt, of David himself. If you go back to the second book of Samuel, you'll see there in chapter 5, as David is taking possession of the land of Israel and taking over the various tribes and so on, it was the normal thing for a king then to establish the city of the king. And there he would have his headquarters. From there he would rule. And this was the case with David in the second book of Samuel chapter 5. He comes to Jerusalem. The Jebusites are in possession. 2 Samuel 5 verse 6. The king and his men went to Jerusalem and to the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spake unto David, saying, except you take away the blind and the lame, thou shalt not come in thither. Thinking David cannot come in thither. Who's David? You can't come in here. We're the Jebusites. We're in our stronghold. You cannot come in. What do we read? Nevertheless, verse 7, David took the stronghold of Zion, the same as the city of David, and so on. And here we have the son of David depicted for us, the great and glorious King of the Jews, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And the question is, who is this one that seeks admission to come in here to take possession of this city to set up his kingdom, because that's what David was doing. He took Jerusalem from the Jebusites. He made it the city of David. He set it up. He set his throne there. He built his palace there. That became his possession. And here is a depicted for us the glorious Redeemer himself. And he comes to take possession of his kingdom. And the command is, lift up your heads, O ye gates, that he might come in. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in and take possession. This is his entrance into his kingdom. Now, when we come to the New Testament, we have John the Baptist, and he's the forerunner. He goes before the Redeemer, and what does he begin to do? What's his ministry about? He's introducing the people to the kingdom. And he speaks of one. He says, he must increase, I must decrease, because the kingdom belongs to him. I'm not even worthy to unloose his shoe latchets and so on. He's the great King of glory. The kingdom belongs to him. And John was the forerunner, as it were, saying to the gates, open up. The king has come, the king has come to take possession of his kingdom. And then we, of course, know that Jesus preached the kingdom, and he was able to say, the kingdom of heaven is already among you. So this psalm is pointing us not only to the Messiah, but to the glorious one who takes control. And you will see here God, the great God of all the earth, who possesses the very fullness of it. And in his beloved Son, he comes to take the kingdom, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? And we have this picture of the glorious creator and sustainer of the universe coming to dwell among men. The prophet Isaiah, on different occasions, he speaks of the greatness of God, and yet how God condescends to dwell among men. And the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 57, we read there in verse 15, thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him that is of a contrite and humble spirit. There's God's company. And that's what we have in Psalm 24. Who keeps company with God, and who God keeps company with? It is a great blessing to be in the company of God. I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and a humble spirit. We dwell together. That's God's company. How blessed it is that God, being so great, he owns the universe, he controls it, but who is the company that he delights in? Poor men and women of a contrite and humble spirit, but particularly the one whom he gives his blessing to, who said, learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart. The one who was equal with God and yet humbled himself in order to save his people. And this is the one that is depicted for us here. He stands before God. He receives the divine benediction, the blessing. And in it he receives gifts for men, even for such as did rebel, the psalmist says. And he comes to take possession of his kingdom. And he takes the possession of his kingdom as he takes the hearts of his poor people and as he takes them into his possession. But what a glorious promise it is. The King of Glory, Psalm 2, you see the nations, the heathen raging, the people imagining a vain thing. And the Lord of Glory takes possession and his kingdom is established. And because his kingdom is established, as Zechariah tells us there in the 14th chapter of that little prophecy, the day will come when his kingdom will so flourish that the very bells and the horses will say holiness unto the Lord. Everything he will bring into subjection to himself. This is a very beautiful psalm depicting the Redeemer in a very special and in a very unique way, the King of Glory. And then notice how the psalm ends in a peculiar way. Selah. So the intention is, when we come to the end of it, we stop and we reflect and we ask, who is this King of Glory? Who is he? Do I know him? Am I related to him? Is he my king? Is he taking possession of me and of my heart? That's what we're supposed to be doing. We just don't read the psalm and think, well, we fulfilled an exercise. We've gone through the motions. We are supposed to sit down and think about this king and who he is and what he has done. But we shall leave it there. May God bless his word.